Hello, everybody. My name is Atul Arya. I'm Chief Energy Strategist at IHS Market. I want to welcome you all to a CERAWeek Agora conversation brought to you by IHS Market. Joining me today for this conversation are Barbara Berger, who is the President of Chevron Technology Ventures, Vijay Swarup, who is the Vice President and Head of Research and Development for ExxonMobil, and Bob Armstrong, who is the Director of MIT Energy Initiative. So in this conversation today, we are going to talk about innovation, the future of innovation in the world post-COVID-19, and how this innovation ecosystem is going to evolve and what is going to happen to the pace of energy transition after this pandemic is over. Welcome all of you to this technology and to CERAWeek Conversations.
Nice to be here.
Good to see you.
So what we're going to do in this conversation is we're going to talk a little bit about what is happening now, and then we will focus much more around innovation and particularly how we see energy innovation progressing even beyond the current health crisis. So question to all of you, this is crisis, this pandemic has changed the way we are all working and the focus of the company. So could you briefly talk about how has that impacted your work, as well as what is your company doing? A couple of things around that, helping with this, with the crisis. So Vijay, maybe I start with you.
Well, thanks, Atul, and it's great to see you and Bob, Barbara. Look forward to the discussion. So we've all, and I certainly hope that everybody is healthy and safe at home. We've all been impacted in one way or another by this pandemic, and hopefully everybody is responding well. In terms of our company, we're really relying on two core strengths of our corporation. One is technical expertise, and the other is care for our communities. So if you think about technical expertise, we've done things like upping our production of key raw materials like polypropylene and isopropyl alcohol. What many people don't appreciate sometimes is that these polymers and these raw materials are keys to masks and gowns and hand sanitizers and things like that. So we've been working on applying our technologies and applying our capabilities to produce the very needed raw materials that work their way through the supply chain that you hear about on the news all the time. And of course, in terms of care for communities, we continue to work with our communities in which we operate, both by making donations as well as working within the communities where we can. And in the U.S., we've donated close to $1 million across the U.S., including states like New Jersey, New Mexico, and Texas. So this is an unprecedented time we're in, and we're all doing what we can to help respond to this crisis.
So Vijay, just a quick follow-up. You are actually running labs and operations like that. Yeah. So remote working and labs don't quite go well together, right?
I think we'll get into this a little more as we talk about the technologies that are enabling our ability to do what we're doing. So we continue to operate the labs when the labs have to be operated. But what we're finding is, we can do a lot from our homes. We can do a lot of the analysis. We can do a lot of the data manipulation. And quite frankly, we can do a fair amount of monitoring from home as well. So yes, we are continuing to work where people have to be on the premises to conduct an experiment. We're conducting those experiments. But other than that, we're doing as much as we can, and we're maximizing how much we do from home.
Okay, thank you. So Barbara, same question to you.
Glad to be here, and some of what we're doing will be very similar to ExxonMobil from an employee standpoint, from a company standpoint, and community, but maybe just add a couple of things there. We have some 28,000 employees that can't work at home, and so in refineries, out on the rigs and platforms and so forth. So clearly their safety is just as important as my safety, and so we've had to adjust some of our operating practices relative to that, really to keep them safe. And they need to be working out in the operations because they need to be producing the fuels that are used in so many of the operations from the pandemic. So I would add that piece. I think the other piece that a number of the companies are working in is companies do scale and execution really well. And so we have had to develop new supply chains. We've all seen that, for masks, for ventilators, for things like that. And so we've been partnering with other corporations to develop new supply chain guidelines and really bring supply chains up from scratch to be able to meet the demand that we're seeing for this. So it's all in at the employee level, at the local level, all the way up to the national and global level.
Thank you. Yeah, very good point on the operational side, because the world is still, you know, people are still driving somewhat, and but there is operations going on and providing material for the healthcare. So that's pretty important. Right? So Bob, now you're in a slightly different position at MIT. I know that MIT, like many other universities, is not does not have any students. So how is that working out now for MIT?
Well, so first, thank you for having me on. And I echo Vijay's statements. I hope everybody is safe and well as they're sheltering at home or wherever you are. So we do have students. They're just not on campus right now. And that's a notable difference, as you pointed out, between us and maybe industry. So in addition to like industry, we have moved what we can of our laboratories, shut those down, except for critical laboratory personnel. But the on-campus education program has also shifted to off-campus. So now we're teaching all of our classes after our spring break are done online with Zoom. We have 1,000 faculty experimenting with how best to do this. I think we're fortunate at MIT that we've been investing in digital education for years before this. So I think we're in pretty good shape to embark on this experiment. But still, there's a lot to learn about how best to do that. And how do you maintain the kind of personal contact with students and advisees when you're remote? And so we're working hard to do that. Another difference may be that we do have a number of faculty research groups on campus that are quite involved in developing ways to address the COVID-19 crisis. So there are groups that are looking at diagnosis, at treatment scenarios, at vaccine development. And those are the only experiments, those are the only labs that are still open on campus. And yet, even with those labs, we have to be careful about how do we maintain social distancing in those. How do we help the researchers to be safe while they continue that work to develop treatments to the problem that we're facing today? Now, we've also done a number of other things to respond. We're not making materials in large quantities like industry can do. But at MIT, one of the things that the Energy Initiative has done is to spin out a company a couple of years ago called E25 Bio, which was developed originally to make rapid assays for detecting infectious diseases like dengue and Zika in developing countries in particular. Now, they found that it's possible to adapt their technology to the coronavirus. And so they now have an assay, rapid assay. It's about a 15-minute turnaround, which can be used to determine whether you are carrying the virus. And you can actually determine whether you have had the virus or whether you actively have it at the moment. So it's interesting that technology is read out by a cell phone. You actually take a picture of the device with your cell phone. So there's capability, if the user is willing, to transmit those results to health organizations so that they can have a better handle on where the disease incidence is increasing the most, where the people are that have the disease, and help, I think, with the treatment plans going forward.
Thank you, Bob. We'll come back to the innovation, which is happening. But good to know that students are still learning and not just on a prolonged vacation here. So I want to, of course, the crisis we have today is a health crisis. But energy is kind of all over helping with this crisis. So it'll be interesting for our audience to hear a little bit about how is energy, you know, the importance of energy within this health crisis. So maybe go back to you, Barbara, to say, you know, when you reflect on it and the contribution of energy, what comes to your mind?
Well, I think threefold. So first of all, try doing any of the pandemic response without energy. So transportation, all the lighting in medical centers, all the things that energy goes into the economy, that all still needs to be done, and it needs to be done reliably. The second piece is that we've had some significant changes to our industry at the same time, some from a very large dramatic drop in demand, but also an increase in supply, which is being adjusted. And so we also have to understand what that does to our industry and what it does to our company. And then I think the third piece, and probably the piece that'll be interesting to talk more about, is that our industry is also undergoing a change. And, you know, I don't think any of the drivers for that change have changed. You know, the world still is looking for a need to decarbonize and go to a lower carbon future. So we have to kind of look at all three of those elements. And, you know, obviously there's things you do in the short term, but that long-term gain, you know, has not changed. And so we still need to have an eye to that. And what do we need to continue to do while we supply currently? We address any changes in the attractiveness of our industry from a supply-demand perspective in the short term, and then also invest in the longer term relative to the transition.
I want to pivot to Vijay here for a minute. So Vijay, you can go back to the question about the role of energy, but also talk a little bit about what Barbara is saying about the importance of the longer term goal here around the energy transition, dealing with the climate challenge, and in the context of a very significant drop in oil price, which clearly impacts oil companies in a big way. So.
Yeah, so I'll build off of what Barbara said, and I think it's a really good thing to talk about, because it once again reinforces how essential energy is to what we do. It's taken for granted, but can you imagine what we're doing, as Bob described, having 1,000 teachers or professors working remotely? Students are still going to school, they're just not going to school. They're attending school, they're not going to school. And everything below that, whether it's this video conference we're doing, whether it's the other thing, everything is underpinned by energy. So we've already talked about the polypropylene and the isopropyl alcohol, the actual materials, which obviously come from energy. But energy is everywhere. And yet, as we talk about a lot, there's about 1 billion people out there who don't have the access to the energy. So that long-term challenge that Barbara talked about hasn't gone away. If anything, it's become even more identified that if you don't have the energy, it is hard to imagine doing what we're doing without the energy. So we've got to close that energy gap and make sure that energy can be affordable and scalable as we provide it. And of course, we have to do it while reducing emissions. And so the long-term game, and of course, as a guy in research, we live in a long-term horizon. That doesn't change. What this has done is it has reinforced a couple of key principles that we have. One is that energy really does underpin just about everything we do. It is essential to quality of life. And number two, and you hear this even in the current environment, is scale really does matter. And the complexity of the scale that you read about and you hear about in the news right now are, from a volumetric standpoint, orders of magnitude below what we have to do in energy. So as we come up with the new solutions and working with folks like MIT and working with others to help develop the next set of solutions, we have to have that line of sight to scale. But again, as we've talked many times in these various conferences, energy, the capital intensity, the time it takes to deploy, it just takes a little bit longer. So you've got to maintain that long-term focus. Obviously, you're cognizant of what's going on right now, but from a research standpoint, you've got to have that long-term focus to get the solutions you need.
Yeah. So as you said, the scale is a really big challenge, and all of you in some different ways are involved in scaling up technologies, getting them to, you know, where they can be applied and make a big difference on emissions. So Bob, I want to start with you on, do you see any changes in the priorities, say, for example, within MIT Energy Initiative as a result of the crisis? And also talk a little bit about the drop in emissions we are seeing. You know, how sustainable do you think they are, and will they disappear as soon as the world is back to work?
Well, so let me tee off on the last part of that question and go back to the question that Vijay and Barb answered, namely about the need for energy and its importance to our economy. we can turn that around and use energy consumption as a way to understand what has been the impact of this virus on our economy. And so one of the things we're doing at the Energy Initiative is taking some of the large data sets we've put together over the last number of years and the ongoing data acquisition capability that's been built up with that to see if we can use those data to provide almost real-time predictions of impacts of the virus and its spread and its a number of cases on the economy, not just nationwide, but in specific parts of the country or in different parts of the world. We think that could be extremely helpful to government organizations and individual organizations like our companies and our universities as we grapple with how do we restart after the coronavirus. So how can you understand impacts of the virus on these different parts of the economy and try to ratchet those up as you need to with data available now as opposed to waiting for 3 months, say, for economic indicators to come in and be useful to you. Also, as Vijay and Barb both mentioned, this is not a time to hit the pause button in energy research. We will see very clearly this very critical agenda that's in front of us for providing the energy that people don't have around the world, and at the same time driving out carbon emissions from the energy sector. And so getting all hands on deck to accelerate that so we don't have another crisis down the road around climate that we haven't addressed in time to meet the needs of society going forward. So we're going full tilt on that. We have the opportunity in this pause in people being on campus to I think maybe do a little bit deeper thinking about what new things we can do as we look at solutions to providing energy with no carbon content going forward. So I'm actually quite excited about what we can do there, particularly in collaboration with our partners as we look to ideas that we can scale up.
Bob, you had mentioned when we spoke about an indicator, which is a very timely indicator about what is happening, and you're making use of that, you and your colleagues at MIT. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so that's what I was getting at a little bit earlier, is it looking at energy use. So we begin with the electricity sector. That's a good indicator. You have good data with balancing authorities, for example, around the U.S. And you can see how electricity use changes with time during the crisis. You can go back, say, a year. So I can look at April 20th a year ago and see what the weather was like then compared to the weather today and do some weather adjustment on the energy loads. That sort of data has been useful in the past at understanding economic activity where good data on that is not available. So you use energy use as a proxy. We're also looking at the natural gas usage data that we have. So we want to understand what sorts of energy needs are in industry. And how is the virus impacting those uses of energy? So process industries, metals processing, and so on.
So very timely data to make some good decisions.
Yes.
Barbara, I want to come back to your kind of day job, which is, Chevron Technology Ventures. And this is a pretty challenging time for many of the startups, right? Because cash is short and cash is very important. And they're looking at companies like yours to say, how do they keep the operations, their operations going? So how are you working with them? Tell us a little bit about the kind of conversations you're having with them and the help you're providing them.
Sure. And, cash preservation happens at many levels in the economy right now, from your household to the startups to the nonprofits and all the communities that we work in and or live in and Chevron. But, we have 21 years of investing in startups. We have a good set of portfolio companies. And And some of the steps that they're going through, their playbook is not that much different than Chevron, but it's a difference from a scale perspective. So, you know, first assess their employees, make sure they're safe and healthy. So, you know, every one of them is going through that same exercise as Chevron went, who can work remotely, who can't. And then a real assessment on how does what we're, you know, the lifestyle in the short term and the business implications impact their company. Some of them, you know, they're all at different stages. So some of them are pre-revenue, and so they're in a different place than post-revenue. And some are directly targeted at our industry in a way that can really help us. And so their business has not slowed down. Others, their business is much more around, say, rig activity out in the Permian. Well, they're vulnerable. So, you know, each one of them looks that way. And then they really need to do self-help. Again, no different than you would do at different scales is you know, what can you do from a cost perspective? Are there government programs that you can apply for? Are there additional opportunities from a revenue perspective? And they're all going through that. And then I think the last piece, and the piece that you talked about, is, so what is their financing, you know, activities? What was it planned to be, and what can they do? And right now is not a great time to be raising new funds. But we have made a commitment, and many investors have made a commitment. We're sticking with our portfolio companies. So if they do all that front-end work, we're there for them. And we're testing with other investors because we're a minority investor. So we want to make sure, you know, the reason why we invested in these companies has not changed. We see breakthrough technology that has applicability in the energy landscape. And so we want to help them. And, you know, so that's kind of the conversation. It's a lot of work. So we're spending a lot of time, you know, with those companies, with the other investors. And the other thing is that we still, even with all those companies, we still have gaps in the technologies that we see are needed in the energy system of the future. So we're still looking at additional things to put in the pipeline. Probably a little bit of the conversation that Bob said is, we get a chance to take a good close look at them right now. Because companies aren't rushing into funding, but we still see good opportunities out there. So
can you say a little bit more about maybe not specific company, but maybe one or two technologies you think are worth taking another look at, maybe investing more in?
Well, you know, I never talked about companies because that would be like you talking about one of your children and not the other, right? Mm-hmm. But you know, I think all three of us probably have some real affinity for the need for, you know, CCUS for the existing operations and the, you know, the existing industry. So, you know, we are helping our companies in the capture space to scale. But I think the other piece that, I, you know, in the current energy system, and Bob mentioned all the data. So having data to tell you, you know, where your emissions are, where you have opportunities to improve from an optimization standpoint. We all have much more sets of information to be able to run our business differently. So I do think there's a number of companies in that space. They're more software plays. Sometimes they're software plus sensors or Internet of Things and stuff. So there's a lot of opportunities in that one. So those are I think some of the ones that we continue to see as having good applicability in terms of the decarbonizing of our industry.
Yeah. So Vijay, same question to you. Technologies you think are interesting to you, do more of, less of?
You know, one of the things that we've learned and it's reinforced is the need for collaboration. And I think you're seeing that playing out today in the medical industry. So that's part of innovation, and it is making sure that you have the right partners and the right collaborators. So in terms of our long range research portfolio, by definition, because it's long range, we don't see a shift there. We are committed to scalable technologies that we think are consistent with the energy solutions that the world is going to need, society is going to need, while reducing emissions. So that continues. Our work in biofuels continues. On our algae research, that continues. Our carbon capture research continues. And our process intensification research continues, which is essentially taking energy out of the energy manufacturing. But I think the one of the lessons that we're learning, as we do have time to reflect, as Bob said, is the real need for collaboration and the need for collaboration earlier, not later. So we've talked a lot, Bob and I have talked a lot about this, about how we have to change the way energy research is done. It used to be done in a very much a series approach where the universities would do the discovery, the national labs would do a scale, and then industry would come in and take that final step to the big capital investment, as Barbara said, this is a capital intensive industry. What we've started to do, and this reinforces that we need to do more of it, is work collaboratively in the earlier stages. So work more with MIT as they're doing proof of principle to kind of guide that, guide the fundamental understandings, and then have line of sight to scale. So over the past couple of years, we've built up our collaborations to expand several universities, the national labs working with the Department of Energy, to foreign universities in countries like India. And what this has done to small companies that we work with as well. And it's really connecting the dots, getting the collaborations there, and understanding that this is an all-in effort here. And we've got to continue to stay focused while continuing to look at innovative ways to collaborate and drive towards solutions.
You know, we had the big study completed last December by National Petroleum Council. And we at CERAWeek were going to have a half a dozen conversations around carbon capture. Where do you think we are now? And, you know, that's a grand collaboration needed.
I think, first of all, I think everybody agrees that carbon capture has to be part of the solution. And there is technology today to do carbon capture. We've been doing it for decades. Others do it today. Barbara is very familiar with it. So there is technology out there today, but we also know that it's not the perfect technology. We know that it's fairly capital intensive, and it's parasitic in power. It requires a lot of energy to do the carbon capture. So we're looking at game-changing technologies. We're certainly looking at modular approaches. We're looking at approaches like our electrochemical approach using a fuel cell that could actually generate power while capturing the CO2. And then more recently, and I think this is important, is we've expanded our portfolio to start thinking about direct air capture. Now, I got to tell you, that would have not been something I would have said a few years ago, but that space is moving. There's more research being done in that space. At the end of the day, it's a materials challenge. You need to have the right material, and it's a separations challenge. To get to net zero, which you hear a lot about, you're going to need negative emissions technologies. So direct air capture, we think, is one that could be at scale. Now, that's earlier stage than conventional carbon capture, or point source, as it's often called, which has already been deployed at scale for several decades. But again, it's bringing it all together and now trying to do things in parallel rather than in series, so that we have a basket of solutions, a portfolio of solutions that can be then deployed.
So Bob, you're doing a lot of work on carbon capture at MIT. What's your prognosis?
We are. And before I go to that, let me talk a little bit about picking up on some things Vijay said and Barb said about the system and working across the energy system. One of the needs that we have had there is capability to better understand the impacts of new tools, new technologies, new pathways that we choose to deal with carbon mitigation. We've developed recently at MIT a tool called SESAME. It's the Sustainable Energy Systems Analysis and Modeling Environment. I thank ExxonMobil. We did this in collaboration with them when we launched the project. The idea in this project is to provide a tool that allows you to look at pathways. So from a pathway being from a source of energy all the way to an end use of energy and everything in between. A tool that will allow you to look at many, many of these pathways. The tool we have now does more than 1,000 pathways, accounts for better than 90% of emissions from the energy sector in the U.S. It's a tool that provides the capability for policymakers, for technologists, for strategists to look at what are the best ways going forward to reduce carbon emissions and the effects across parts of the energy system. So not just within the power system, for example, where we've looked and spent a lot of our efforts so far, but technologies or pathways that can positively affect transportation, industry, buildings, along with power. So what provides us the capability to multiply our impact across those different sectors? We are going to roll this out within the next month here at one of these CERAWeek broadcasts. So I'll ask people to stay tuned to this website to see the rollout. This is shameless advertising here, but I think people will find it very interesting, in part because as a framework, as a systems tool, it gives different groups around the world the chance to integrate the work they've done into that tool to provide system understanding. So, for example, work that Argonne National Labs has done on transportation fleets, right? Now, we can bring that information into the SESME model and use that to understand better impacts of different technologies, different engine types, fuel types, and so on emissions in the transportation sector. So I think that's a very exciting piece of work. And I think, although not long-term research, it is important to understand what does our agenda need to be for the long term to have the kind of impact that we want to have. I'll go back to the question you actually did ask, which is, what are we doing in carbon capture and sequestration? And the answer is a lot, like ExxonMobil and Chevron are doing. What one of the exciting results out of MIT very recently, a couple of weeks back, is the spin out of a new carbon capture technology company. The idea with this company is a electro swing technology. So people from the process industry have no doubt heard of temperature swing absorption technologies, pressure swing absorption technologies. In this case, you swing voltage in the system. And as with these other swing technologies, you have parallel trains. One of those trains operating at one voltage setting captures CO2, basically CO2 rich streams flowing between parallel plates that are electrodes in a battery. Think of it that way. While the other train, the parallel train, is desorbing. So you absorb in one train, desorb in the other train, and you oscillate back and forth between those two trains. Interesting part of this is because it's just a very slight voltage change to go from absorbing to desorbing, it consumes very little energy. It also works quite well across a wide range of CO2 concentrations. So you can go from the concentrations of flue gas, which has been the target historically, to what we've just been talking about, direct air capture. So it actually works just as well at the 400 parts per million, which we have today. So that sort of technology is exciting. I think the research going on in laboratories at MIT and other universities and national labs is similarly exciting, because I think we have got to crack the CCUS problem and find ways to do it very affordably to make the kind of headway we need at meeting climate change.
So before we wrap, I have one other technology question, and we'll come back to the future, which is around hydrogen, because, you know, hydrogen has been probably the hottest thing going around. You know, we always have these cycles of one technology getting a lot of attention. So Barbara, I'll start with you. What's your view on the potential for hydrogen? And clearly manufacturing costs will be a key issue. What do you think? Can we get the cost down?
The potential is great, and it's always been great. I'm encouraged by the amount of innovation, the fact that dollar signs are used a lot more in the conversations than they used to be. So we're really focused on reducing the cost. And I think also marrying different technologies together. So from a green hydrogen perspective, finding ways to take very inexpensive renewable electricity into that, from an SMR, finding ways to capture the CO2 or even capture it within a closed system. So I'm excited about it, and we're seeing a lot of startup innovative technologies that I think have gotten the problem right. And once you've gotten the problem right, I think then, you know, innovative minds will help us figure out the solution.
Great. Same question to you, Vijay.
Yeah, so I'm going to try to connect two things there, one that Bob mentioned and then one that Barbara just mentioned. So what Barbara basically said is there's multiple options. And what Bob talked about when he was describing the tool that can do integrated assessment models or integrated comparisons is the ability to understand how various systems compare with each other. In this case, if you're trying to understand the CO2 footprint. If you take green hydrogen, it's still going to require power from somewhere. Yeah. And the question is, well, how did you get that power? And so understanding the sources all the way from the very beginning, because even wind or solar require energy to make the panels or to make the turbines that are used. And so this tool that MIT has been developing now for several years. So while Bob might have very modestly said this has not been a long-term effort, it's been multiple years, and it's very hard to do that and to do it transparently. So I think, you know, hydrogen has, it's all of the above. You always want to compare. That's sort of the nature of the way we think. But the reality is it's all going to matter. And then having a tool that can allow you to understand the pros and cons, particularly from a CO2 standpoint, that's been something that many have attempted to do, but it is extremely complicated to understand what the CO2 footprint is of one energy pathway versus another. And so I think the work that's going on in terms of understanding how to do these comparisons that MIT is leading, I think is critical. And then companies like ours, trying to understand the various pathways to make the hydrogen and then understanding the scalability of those pathways, I think is important. You know, if you think about a methane molecule, that's four hydrogens and one carbon. That's a very efficient way to get the hydrogen. Now it just depends on in the process of making the hydrogen, there will be CO2. Then how do you connect the dots, as Barbara mentioned? Do you take an SMR plus CCS? Now you've got two technologies that together might be able to be a big part of the solution. So I think it's open mind, it's understanding, collecting dots, connecting dots, understanding how these systems integrate together. And then with some of the work that MIT is doing, be able to have a transparent way to understand what the carbon footprint is for these various approaches.
Right. So my and Bob, you can talk about hydrogen briefly if you want, but my final question to all of you is that, how do you see any changes in the energy innovation ecosystem because of what is happening right now?
So I'll start with just a word or two about hydrogen. I echo what Barb and Vijay said. I think hydrogen is positioned to play a role that's difficult to do otherwise. For example, for long-haul transportation applications that are carbon-free, having hydrogen as fuel could be extremely valuable. Providing high temperature heat for process industries, hard to think of other ways to do that. Maybe we will, but right now hydrogen seems like a particularly good way to do that. Same with heat for buildings. In the power sector, a big challenge that's clearly in front of us is how do you address long-term storage issues. A fuel like hydrogen could do that. In fact, if you start developing or deploying hydrogen for long-term storage, probably you'll use those same assets to do much shorter time scale services as well. Now, I also think that this challenge we're in right now offers a really interesting opportunity for us, say the government, as we're looking at stimulus programs, to think about infrastructure that will be important for a future low-carbon energy system. Piece of that that's been talked about a lot, of course, is transmission. I think we should be doing more of that. But I think starting to build out a hydrogen infrastructure based on the fact that today we can already make hydrogen quite cheaply with SMR plus CCS. That's the cheapest way to get there. Let's start trying to build out those systems in areas where there is capability to make that hydrogen, say in the greater Houston area, where there's a lot of capacity to do that, in the Marcellus, where there's capacity in natural gas where you could convert that to hydrogen plus carbon sequestration and ship hydrogen if you had the pipeline infrastructure, probably done through retrofits. California could benefit. So there are lots of different parts of the U.S., I think, where you could try to begin the build out of that infrastructure, which would accelerate, I think, the cost reductions in hydrogen use for the many applications where it's important.
So looking into the future?
Yeah, so looking into the future, I think touching again on topics that have come up, I think understanding better how to couple supply chain understanding. We have a lot of research going on in the universities, understanding supply chains. That's obviously important, not just to the industrial practice, but it's important for us to understand that up front as we think about processes that could be scalable. So I put supply chains right at the fore. I think manufacturing capabilities, how do we manufacture some of these new processes, products? How do we understand how to do that at an early stage so that we don't invest too much bench scale laboratory work on non-scalable processes? This is an area where machine learning, AI has, I think, become very impactful and beneficial to us to do that early screening that otherwise is hard to do. It takes you 9 years to do a lot of the synthesis that you need to do in materials characterization. If you could bypass those experiments on materials that aren't going to be scalable or processes that aren't going to be scalable, that's an enormous savings, I think, in investment in time and money. So that's another area where I think we're seeing great strides.
Barbara, same question, looking into the future, what do you see?
Well, you know, let's not, you know, minimize the pain and suffering that's going on right now and will go on for quite some time, both on the health standpoint, but also the economic. But there's always a silver lining, and I'm an optimist. So a couple of things that we've talked about today that I would just reinforce. First of all, you know, we always have talked about people's ability to learn and adapt. And we have seen tremendous changes in what we've been able and willing to do in the last month. So the human population is resilient and capable of learning. The second one is, and BJ mentioned this, is collaboration. And so we've collaborated on with lots of players. People come together, organizations come together. So I think that piece is there. You know, my hope is the other two, which is one is, you know, we've learned that you can repurpose and reuse in this. We've seen that in so many different anecdotes around there. So, you know, hopefully that is a thread that continues. And you know, and I would just follow with Bob. You know, we've learned how important supply chains are. And, you know, that it's not just about the first costs, there's a resiliency, there is a length of the supply chain. And I think that's going to help some of the local businesses as they think about opportunities going forward. So tremendous opportunities. It's up to us to pursue them.
Yeah, and I just want to, before I go to Vijay, I just want to mention that we are doing a piece of work, starting it on supply chains, on new energies, you know, because we know that many of the ingredients coming for, say, solar, wind, batteries, they are concentrated. And I think the world has to look at, particularly as we scale to a much larger scale, the importance of supply chains. And it could be good for economies where manufacturing has gone down over the years, right, as you're saying. So Vijay, I'll give you the last word, thoughts for the future.
Yeah, well, first off, I look forward to the future where we can see each other again in person. So I know for one thing, it's for sure. It certainly taught me the value of friendship and the value of how important it is to actually see people and interact with people. And I must admit, that's something that we probably all took for granted. And it has been absolutely reinforced how much the social element is so critically important to us. You know, if I look in the future, I'm going to just build and reinforce just a couple of comments that Barbara and Bob both made. One is that you have to start working on solutions today if you want to be ready for tomorrow. And how you develop those solutions, I think, is where the change is going to be. Look, we've often talked about the energy challenge being a technology challenge. And you have a panel here, which is really made up of technologists at the end of the day. So we know that this is a big, big technology challenge. The question is, how do we advance the technologies? How do we stay open to new ideas? How do we integrate these new ideas? How do we make sure that we're listening? Because you don't want to make this A versus B. You want to make this A and B. Instead of telling somebody why an idea is not good, you really want to connect the yeses. Why is an idea good, and how do you build off that idea? The key here to get to where we want to get, which is a population of 9 billion people, having energy, having affordable, scalable energy while staying within the bounds of emissions limits, is we're going to have a set of technologies that can be deployed at scale. And my view is that what we've learned here is we've got to get that collaboration going, whether it's supply chain, whether it's new materials, whether it's data, whether it's, you name it. Energy is going to require every science, every technology, every engineering, all pulled together. And I think what we've learned is we got to bring that human element. We got to bring everybody together. We got to break down the walls. We got to collaborate. We got to work together to solve this problem. I think the other thing we're seeing is science wins. Technology will win. Technology is there. It's a question of how do we speed up the discovery, how do we speed up the development and the deployment. And again, the final word I'd use is collaboration. We're going to have to find ways to collaborate to get these solutions at scale quicker.
Thank you. Thank you, Vijay. Thank you, Barbara. Thank you, Bob, for this terrific conversation. My own reflection would be, you know, after such a big drop in the global economic activity, we're probably going to see between 5 to 6% based on the current estimates, drop in emissions year on year, change in emissions, and at a massive economic cost. So it just says, as I think, Vijay, you said, you know, the scale of the challenge of energy challenge is significantly larger than the health challenge, not to minimize what we need to do today, what the world needs to do today. So a big challenge. And, you know, I look forward to seeing all of you in person next year, March 1 through 5, 2021 in Houston, Texas for CERAWeek, where this conversation will continue. With that, thank you very much. And thank you, everybody, for joining us today for CERAWeek Agora Conversation, presented by IHS Markit.